Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Paul Gilbert. He's head of the Mental Health Research Unit and Professor of Clinical Psychology at the University of Derby, where he developed compassionate mind training and compassionate focus therapy. And he has kindly agreed to talk to us today about these practices. Paul, welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Barry.
Okay, so could we start by you telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, well, I'm a professor of clinical psychology, although I didn't start as a psychologist, actually. I started as an economist, and I grew up in Nigeria for a lot of my early life. And anyway, so I did economics, but I always wanted to work with people. So in those days, it was relatively easy to be able to change when you're at university. So I finished my degree, and I then took a degree in psychology, and then I went on to study depression. And from there, I became interested in developing the treatments for depression, particularly for people who have got what we call resistant or difficult to treat depressions. So the last nearly 38 years now, I've been working as a clinical psychologist with people with complex difficulties.
Okay. And so what is your understanding of compassion?
Well, it's a great question, that, because many people have a very, very vague idea about compassion. So if you run a group, particularly for men, and you ask them about compassion, they go a little bit sort of sheepish and think it's about, being soft and weak and gentle and all that. Now, in reality, and this, as you would know, comes from the Buddhist traditions, particularly the Mahayana traditions, compassion can be defined as a sensitivity to suffering with a commitment to try to alleviate and prevent it, okay? Now, that means there are two basic psychologies to compassion. The first one is the psychology to pay attention to suffering.
Yeah.
That means that we don't close out from it, we don't deny it, we don't turn our backs on it. And that's paying attention to the suffering in other people, but also within ourselves.
Yeah.
And what we know is that people who have mental health problems often try and close down. They try to avoid their feelings. They want to use drugs or alcohol or whatever it is to stop feeling what they're feeling. So the first aspect of compassion is this capacity for being able to tolerate, to look into, to make sense of the nature of suffering. Mm-hmm. The second psychology is this preparedness to engage with developing the wisdom to know what to do about it. Okay. So the first psychology is intention, that's great, and the ability to engage, that's great, but it has to be backed up with the preparedness to work to do the alleviation and prevention bit. And of course, that's why people, if you take somebody like a medic wanting to cure people, that's great, but the intention is not enough. You then got to go and study for years and years and years. So that's all part of the compassion journey, right?
Okay.
The other point about compassion is that compassion is about encouragement. I mean, if you imagine that you've got something difficult to do, like, going to the hospital to get some tests done because you're concerned with a nasty illness or something like that, or you're going through a divorce, what would you want from a compassionate friend? Well, you'd want somebody who was going to listen to you, be kind to you, and validate your feelings. For sure, you would.
Yeah.
But you'd also want somebody who would help you face difficulty. You don't want somebody who's going to say to you, oh, well, those are terribly frightening things. Just accept it and, stay at home. You don't need to worry. Life will be what life is. A compassionate friend would actually help you do the things that are difficult for you to do. Mm-hmm. So this is a key to compassion as well, is how do we build the courage to do the things and face the things that are hard for us?
Yeah.
So compassion is about our abilities to descend into our suffering, to move into our suffering, and acquiring the wisdom of knowing what to do when we engage with it. So that's what compassion is. It's nothing about being soft or weak or any of that stuff. It's a very clear focusing on compassion with a desire to do something about it.
And how did you then come to develop CFT, compassion and focus therapy?
Well, compassion focus therapy is compassion focus therapy. In other words, the emphasis is sort of on the focused. In other words, we use lots of other aspects of therapy, but we focus them. So why do we focus them? Why do we call it, you know, focusing the therapy with compassion? Well, the process started very simply, actually. About 25 years ago, I was working again with chronic depressed people, and they could do some cognitive things. Now, in cognitive therapy, you help people identify thoughts that are linked to the depression, such as they feel like a failure, they've wasted their lives, the future's never going to change. And of course, if you have those thoughts going around in your mind all the time, then that's going to make you feel pretty depressed. So yeah. In cognitive therapy, you help people stand back and you begin to look at these thoughts in alternative ways. So patients could say, well, actually, I can see that I have succeeded in some things. You know, I mean, my marriage is okay, or I'm holding down a job, or whatever it is. And so for some people, if you stand back and take this wider perspective, this really helps them. And they can say, yes, I can see my depression has trapped me in a way of thinking, and I don't have to think like that. And when I change how I see the situation, I feel a lot better. And that's great. But what we found was, particularly for our more tricky, complex cases, is that they didn't feel that. They say, yes, I can see that logically I'm not a failure in the way that I think I am. I can see logically I've got so much more in my life than, you know, 90% of the world. I can see logically, you know, I can see, I can hear, I've got all my senses, nobody's persecuting me, I've got enough to eat, blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't make any difference, right? So what happened was I had a couple of people all at the same time, as it turned out. So I said to them, well, when you hear these alternative thoughts in your mind, you're looking, you're standing back saying, well, look, you know, I've succeeded at this, or I've done this, or whatever it is. You're taking this different, more realistic perspective on your life. How do you actually hear it in your mind?
Mm.
And what happened was I discovered that patients actually heard their alternative thoughts in a very hostile, aggressive way. So although they were saying to themselves, look, actually, the evidence is you've done quite well and things aren't as bad as you think they are, or whatever, the tone of that was very much like, look at the evidence. You're being very stupid. You're making mountains out of molehills. You know that actually your life is a lot better, that you've succeeded at the, you know.
Yes.
So I thought, oh, my gosh. So I said to him, well, okay, so what would happen if you just created a kind voice? Let's sit in the clinic now and just create a kind voice as if you were talking to somebody who you really cared about, and you put as much friendliness into your voice as you could. And it turned out they couldn't do it. They said, oh, no, I couldn't do that. That's weak. That's soft. That would be letting myself off the hook. Or if I'm kind to myself, it just makes me really sad. And yeah, I've got to push myself. Come on, you know, you, and all that stuff. So we started the therapy very, very simply of generating what we call affiliative emotion, friendly emotion, so that people could have a friendly feeling for themselves.
Yes.
But just having the thoughts, alternative to do it. And that proved a lot more complicated and tricky than we realized. And from there, we developed more and more techniques. And I think it was sort of towards the late 80s, early 90s, colleagues of mine were saying, well, actually, some of the things you're doing, you know, they do this in Mahayana and Buddhist meditation.
Yeah.
Now, I'd been interested in Buddhism since my teens, actually, but never, only as an outsider, really, you know, going to the odd retreat for a day here and a day there.
Yeah.
I'd read a little bit, but that was about it. And so I then became very interested in this whole issue about this, how do you train your mind to be much more focused on compassion, the ability to attend to suffering, and to be able to generate this friendly kindness, or sometimes it's called loving kindness or friendly kindness. And so that became a very key focus. And then we began to sort of develop more techniques from other therapies and integrate some Buddhist practices. So the idea was really just to generate a friendly interior in your head, because a lot of depressed patients are extremely self-critical. Sometimes they even hate themselves. Well, you're not going anywhere with that except more depression. So that's how it all began, really.
Can you think of some specific example of practices that you kick people off with?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things. Firstly, insight is important.
Yeah.
So helping people gain insight into the way in which they think about themselves really does influence bodily processes. And therefore, the tone and the quality of the relationship you have with yourself is key. I mean, for example, if you lay in bed and just let your mind go over an argument you've had that day, what will happen is, of course, that will stimulate all of your frustration and anger systems. You'll start replaying it not only in your mind, but in your body. If you lay in bed and you fantasize an erotic fantasy, then you'll start to get aroused, right? If you lay in bed and you start imagining a holiday that you're about to go on and how exciting that is, then you'll get excited. So it's very clear that the way in which we think and what we imagine can stimulate physiological systems, okay? Yeah. We all know that. So why not use that mechanism of the mind to start to generate images and a focus on compassion? So one of the exercises we develop is, rather than thinking about your erotic fantasy, which you can do, is to create an image of a highly compassionate person. If you could imagine the most compassionate person for you, you know, you could go and design your own compassionate friend or whatever it is. What would they be like? How would they talk to you? How would they support you? And so one of the practices is really just helping people turn their imagination, turn their mind into focusing on relating to a compassionate other. So, and that does stimulate processes in the brain which are conducive to well-being. Another exercise we have is learning to imagine yourself as a compassionate person. So if you were the most compassionate person you could possibly be, what would that be like, right? And we use method acting techniques. So it doesn't matter if you feel you are a compassionate or you're not a compassionate person, just imagine that you were. If you were a compassionate person, well, how would you think? How would you act? What would you do in this situation, okay? So these are techniques where we are getting people to deliberately focus their minds in particular ways in order to stimulate brain processes that are going to be very conducive to recovery from things like depression and shift them out of this interior world of hostility and condemning and dislike into a much more affiliative inner world.
You mentioned that one of your influences is Mahayana Buddhism, but also they're talking about imagining a person that is extremely kind in a very archetypal way. Have you been influenced by the Jungian theory of archetypes? Or what are your other influences?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Actually, I was very got into Jung in a big way when I was in my teens. Interestingly, in those days, we had what we called liberal studies, and I was at college, and we had somebody come and teach us an A-level in it was Jung's influence of archetypes in literature. And so we did this little course, which was to study literature from an archetypal point of view. So there'd be the archetypal hero, the archetypal heroine, the archetypal villain, you know, all this stuff. And that was great. I really got caught up in that. And I actually thought that was what psychology was. And then when I got to university and was studying psychology, it was all about rats and things. I was very disappointed. But then I had an opportunity to work in a Jungian day hospital for about 4 years, and we got supervision while I was doing that, and I got heavily into Jung. So very interested in Jung's concepts of archetypes. We have a slightly different take on an archetype now, but the basic idea is that we come with inherited motivational systems for forming attachments to our parents, for joining groups, for finding sexual partners, for competing for status. I mean, these are fundamentally important ideas, really. Yeah. And the idea of a compassionate other, a caring other, is a fundamental archetype, as you say.
Yeah, in middle way philosophy, which is the backdrop to the middle way society, the Jungian view of his term he used was individuation, I think, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
The concept that we employ in the society is integration, but basic is the same thing. Does his view of individuation resonate with a lot of the work that you do?
Yeah, now it's very interesting, actually, because this is a really, really good point, because from Jung's point of view, individuation is a process of the archetypes kind of blending together. So individuation comes as your archetypes move out of the shadows, as it were. So as you become more aware of the archetypal processes within you and you're able to cope and tolerate those things, then they start to blend together, and eventually individuation grows out from your own individual blending of the hero and the shadow and the persona, you know.
Yeah.
And so on. Now, sort of like that, but in our approach, we have this idea that if you focus on the compassion itself, on what is in Mayan Buddhism called bodhicitta, this desire to address suffering in all forms and all beings. If you focus on that, it actually does something quite interesting to your mind. It is the process of individuation, because what you discover is that if you take a compassionate view to yourself and you realize that we're all just biologically created beings here, right? We're all caught up in this illusions of self and or the hatred and the greed and blah, blah, blah. They're all archetypal patterns.
Yeah.
You're able to kind of stand back from these patterns. And it's not that you disengage from them, but that they don't claim you. So, for example, if you've had an argument with somebody you really care about, we could ask you to tell us, what does your angry self think? What does your angry self feel? What does your angry self want to do?
Yeah.
What does your anxious self think? What does your anxious self feel? What does your anxious self want to do? And is there a part of you that feels sad about the argument because you didn't really want an argument with somebody you care about, obviously? So what does that thing? And what people discover when they do this sort of exercise is, oh my gosh, yes, there are these different parts to me. And they actually think in different ways, and they have different bodily feelings, and they have different action tendencies. That's extraordinary. Yeah. It's quite a simple little exercise, but people often don't do that. Then if you say, okay, so that's all of these parts turn up when you have an argument, right? So they'll be there. One part is usually dominant, either the angry part or the anxious part. You know, if anxious self dominates you, then you'll start appeasing. Oh, let's not argue. Let's, you know, because I'm worried about rejection or upsetting you or whatever. But then if you move into compassion self, right, and the other interesting thing about this is that if you ask people, what does your angry self think about your anxious self? You soon discover that angry self doesn't like anxious self very much, and angry self often sees anxious self as a bit of a wimp, you know. So this is a situation when you wake up, you know, you've had an argument, and you haven't really defended yourself for a while, and you wake up at night and you think, gosh, why didn't I say that, you know. And also, if you look at the other way around, anxious self can be quite frightened of angry self and angry self getting out of control. So those kind of selves, those archetypal processes, if you wish, although they're emotional processes, can be in conflict with themselves. You can be frightened of your anger getting out of control, but you can also be frightened that your anxiety and submissiveness might actually hold you back and you're not able to defend yourself. So then you say, okay, but let's now come back into compassionate self. So we do a breathing exercise, we do an attention focusing exercise, and you're coming back into imagining that you have a calm mind, wise mind, and that you are the most compassionate person you can imagine being, right? Now, it's still in imagination, it's just an imagination. But if you allow yourself just to do the breathing exercises and focus on that, it turns out that compassion self has a lot of wisdom. And compassion self, when it looks at the argument, begins to realize, well, you know, there are two of us in this argument, and maybe both of us had issues, and it's so easy to get disappointed in each other, and it's not such a big deal, first. And secondly, compassion self is able to work with angry self and anxious self and these other selves. So, like, compassion self has the wisdom and the authority, actually, to see, yeah, I get angry, but actually, you know, I don't actually want this to run the show.
Yeah.
Or I don't want my, I want this part of me to become the organizing self. And so the compassionate self then is a way of organizing your mind. It's a motivational system that organizes your mind in such a way that it facilitates the development of individuation, because it is a non-critical, non-judgmental, accepting position within your mind, so it allows these things to exist within you, and you can get to know them, but not necessarily act on them.
When you say organization, could you also say regulates, or would that be appropriate?
To some degree, yes.
Okay, right. You talk about three emotional systems of the brain. Do you see emotion as something separate from reason?
Yes. Now it's very interesting. Human reason is a recently evolved capacity, right? Whereas the emotion systems that drive us are very old. These are old brain systems, whereas our reasoning capacities are new brain. And it turns out that They don't actually always work very well together. Now, one thing that people need to recognize about evolution is that it doesn't actually always produce good designs. For example, when we stood up for hands free, we were primates on all fours, we stood up for hands free and we could see around everything. That standing up moved the pelvis forward slightly and narrowed the birth canal. So it turns out that right at the time when the baby's head was evolving to become bigger, so it turns out that humans have the most dangerous and painful births of all the primates. Why? It's just a trade-off. It's a disadvantage, but the advantage of standing up having hands free was greater. A giraffe's neck, why did that evolve? Well, because it can eat from higher branches. But actually, there are a lot of disadvantages to that. It's easy to fall over and break limbs and so on. Yeah. Now, the human brain turns out to be the same. There are some wonderful things in it. It gives us huge advantages, but also some serious disadvantages. So about 2 million years ago, we started to develop the capacity for reason, for imagining, for anticipating, for having a sense of ourselves, and for self-monitoring. As far as we know, animals don't self-monitor. You'll never see a chimpanzee sit under a tree taking their pulse thinking, oh my God, this is far too high. Or looking in the lake and thinking, have I put on weight or what? Or worrying about what the chimpanzees in the other tree are thinking about them. Humans do, and they can, because they have this self-monitoring system. So self-monitoring is very good because it allows you to make predictions about your behavior. But then if it turns into self-criticism, it's not so good. The other thing is that we create loops in the mind. So, for example, if you imagine a zebra running away from a lion and they get away, very shortly thereafter, they will calm down and they will be back to grazing and with the herd. This doesn't happen for a human, though. Humans will certainly be relieved that they've run away and escaped the lion, but then they'll start imagining. Can you imagine what would have happened if I'd got caught? Oh, my God, choked to death, eaten alive. Oh, my God, that's terrible. They wake up in the middle of the night. What about if there were two lions tomorrow, or I tripped over that log, or I don't see them coming, or what if? Okay, so actually the mind can, because this thinking system can now lock you into loops.
Yeah.
And not only can it lock you into loops, but this mind, this thinking mind, can be used for doing quite bad things. For example, building weapons. No animal builds weapons in the way humans do, whereas we use our intelligence on purpose to design things that are going to harm people and hurt people. So the human mind is great in some ways. We have medicine on the one hand, but we have great cruelty on the other,
yeah.
And partly because of the way in which our mind has evolved. And one of the reasons for that is because the emotion and the motivation systems are very old. They haven't really caught up with the fact that actually it's not good to be building nuclear weapons or biological weapons, actually. This is not a good idea.
Okay. The reason I asked you that, though, that I'm just thinking of a book by Antonio Damasio. He wrote this book called Descartes' Error.
Yeah.
He did lots of these experiments in the 70s with people with brain lesions or strokes, where that part of your brain which is particularly concerned with emotion was knocked out.
Yeah.
And what they found with these people, they didn't know what to want. They lived very chaotic, disorderly lives. This idea that you could have, you know, you could be like Spock off Star Trek and just live off rationality alone, it doesn't seem to work from that understanding.
Absolutely right. Because the logic's fine, right? But what will you value?
Yeah.
Okay. How could you have any value? I mean, the point is, if your children die tomorrow, does that bother you?
Right.
Well, not really. I mean, logically, it's just less mouths to feed, right? So without emotion, your life is barren. You can't function. And we have to remember that up until about 2 million years ago, emotion was the main guiding process for all living, you know, for most animals. It was emotions that actually guided them to resources and food and sex and away from predators. Anxiety made them run away. Sexual desire made them approach. Hunger made them seek out food. So emotions is the main drivers.
So would you say that the fact value dichotomy is too extreme, that facts and values are inextricably linked?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are linked. But values, what you are emotionally connected to, what gives you meaning in your life, is to do with your what textures your life emotionally.
Yeah, okay. Just moving on. How did you first get involved with Buddhist practitioners?
Well, I got involved quite a long time ago at university, right? But as I say, I was very much a dabbler, really.
Yeah.
You know, Buddhism made simple, that sort of thing. You'd read that sort of book. And then gradually became more and more interested in it. And then about 10 years ago, 20 years ago, mindfulness began.
All right.
And so obviously that became interested to psychology. People like Mark Williams and co. in this country started to explore mindfulness as a potential source of a therapy.
Yeah.
Now, I knew a little bit about some of the Buddhist practices, and we were integrating them. I never really thought about it as a therapy in itself. And then I had some meetings with some Buddhist people here from the Buddhist order. And then I met 10 years ago now, nearly, a person called Shodan,
yeah,
who was a Buddhist monk for many, many years in Samiling. We got to talking, and we went to a conference on the neuroscience of compassion, and which was held on the Holy Island, actually, which is a beautiful place with a monastery there. And I presented my evolutionary stuff, and the people there were saying, well, actually, this is a new way of thinking about some of the stuff we've been talking about the content of the mind, you know, how is the content of the mind created and all that stuff. So then they became very interested in, could we use the more scientific view of the mind and pair that into Buddhist insights and practices?
Yeah.
And that's what we do now. That's the book Mindful Compassion, is a integration of the Western science about the brain with Buddhist insights from meditative practices.
Okay. What do you understand by the middle way?
Well, I think if I recall, the Buddha was sitting on a bank and he watched somebody floating by with a violin, and that he was tuning up the violin. And the Buddha realized that if the string was too slack, it wouldn't sound, and if it was too tight, it would break, right? So you remember this story. The middle way is really important because it actually means that things in the right combination produce new phenomena, right?
Yeah.
So it's all to do with balancing the relationship between things to create new things. So, for example, one atom of hydrogen, two atoms of oxygen give water, but that's the only way it will happen. Any other balance, any other combination, it won't happen. That's its combination. Okay, so the issue of balance is very much about how you integrate potentially opposing forces, but not always opposing forces, in such a way that they work together to form new relationships and bring in new things. So, like within your mind, it's how do you use compassion in such a way that also you can be assertive, also you can be engaged in the world, you can have drive, also you can be anxious when you need to be anxious. How are these things balanced? Do they function optimally for the whole organism? So that's my understanding of the middle way.
Okay. Do you see CFT as principally a treatment for people with emotional problems, or do you also have a vision for it as an integrative practice that anyone could take up? I'm thinking of your latest book, Mindful Compassion, which you've written with Shodan, who you've just mentioned.
Oh, yes. Thanks for that, Barry. Yes, it's very much the latter, a series of exercises which anybody can use with benefit, we think. So the point about the model is that there is a way of thinking about understanding the nature of the problems that we've got. Remember, at the beginning, we said compassion is sensitivity to suffering and the desire to alleviate it and prevent it. So that means you've got to understand the causes of it, obviously.
Yeah.
So the human brain actually has a lot of problems with it. It has evolved to have a whole series of archetypes, to use your language, which are very, very tricky for humans to handle. One of them, of course, is tribalism, the tendency for humans to fall into groups quite easily and then to become very hostile to other groups. I mean, we've heard what's been happening in Syria, which is horrendous, but sadly, that behavior has been going on for many thousands of years.
Yeah.
We can think back to the Holocaust, this Holocaust Remembrance Day. I think it was yesterday, wasn't it? Or was it today? No, yesterday. So humans have capacities within them for being really pretty awful. They have capacities within them that will drive them crazy if they let them get loose, right?
Yeah.
So compassion really is about understanding that the human brain is tricky, and therefore we have to train our minds in such a way that we know how to deal with this stuff that goes on. It's not our fault. It's just in there, right? It's because of the way the brain's built. And therefore, the compassion exercises that we are developing and we're continuing to develop is really how to work with what is often quite a difficult mind, a mind that can be full of anger or anxiety or, you know, hostility or tribalism. They're no good. It's all me, or hatred for the outsider. How do you create a mind that's not going to get caught up in all that stuff? And also that if you do some of these practices, you'll find that it will settle your own mind so that you also don't get caught up in all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I'll give you one simple example to show you how powerful these things are. Imagine that you go Christmas shopping and you go into 10 shops, and in 9 of the shops, the people there are extremely helpful to you. They bend over backwards to try to help you and get the present you want, and you're very pleased when you come out of the shop.
Yeah.
But you go into one shop and the assistant is extremely rude. They make you wait, and then they're not that interested in finding you what you want. And then you give them £20 and they give you change for 10 and deny that you gave them 20. And you come out of the shop feeling really pretty annoyed and debating in your mind whether you should talk to the store manager. Now, who do you talk about when you go home? Who are you ruminating about when you go home? So that anger sticks in you.
Yeah.
Then you tell your partner, and that makes them angry on your behalf. So we now got two people who are angry. And but think about this. Hang on a moment. What happened to the other 9 people who were kind to you? What happened to the memories and the focus on them?
Yeah.
What happened to the feelings of actually this, how pleased you were by the helpfulness of people? The fact of the matter is your brain is designed to be threat first. And so it will always seize on the negative. It will seize on the negative because the negative in your brain sticks like Velcro, because your brain is designed for that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the positives slip away. So even though 9 people were really helpful to you, the chances are you're going to get stuck with focusing on the one that really annoyed you. Now, the thing about compassion is, once you see this, this is what your brain will do. It's absolutely not your fault, and you can let it do it if you want, but think about, do you want that? Do you want for your brain to be regulated by your threat system, by this system, which will make you unhappy, make your friend unhappy? It's not good for your heart. It's not good for your digestion. What would about if you was to able to say to yourself, okay, I realize that my anger system is taking control of my mind. It's not my fault, but I'm going to, on purpose, deliberately focus on the other 9 people that were nice to me. I'm going to remember every single one, go through every single one and remember. Because I can promise you, if you do that, the anger will melt away.
Okay. Is there ever a danger, though, that you can overstimulate the soothing system? I was listening to the Today program recently, and someone talking about forgiveness and forgiving someone who'd committed a heinous act towards one of their family, and had this complete, almost absolute view about forgiveness. And I just felt that there was maybe there's a certain denial of certain emotions, that, you know, possibly emotions of rage or whatever, that by just being completely compassionate to this person who'd had really impacted on their lives. I don't know if that's a good example or not, really.
Yeah, it's good. It's a great question, Barry. There are two separate things. That the soothing system is interesting. So just to clarify that, so it's important to recognize you have two very different types of positive emotion. Not one, two. One is activating and stimulating. So if you won the lottery tonight or whenever it is, and you became worth 100 million euros, because it's a lot of money in Europe these days, you would become extremely excited, right? You'd be getting a buzz. You wouldn't be able to sleep for a few days. You'd have a lot of intrusions. Even if you were trying to relax and calm down, every so often it would come into your mind, you're worth 100 million. Amazing. If this programs that you're making gets taken up and given a prize and you become a knight or a sirhood or whatever it is, you're going to get quite excited. So these are exciting emotions, and a lot of the things we do in life are to create exciting emotions, to go out with friends and have a good time and go on holiday and all that. Yeah. And that's fine. But there's another type of positive emotion, which is exactly the opposite. And this is the emotion of contentment, the ability to calm down, to just to be able to enjoy being in the moment, to appreciate the moment for what it is. No drive, no threat, no wanting to achieve, no buzz. And this is it has a very different physiological profile, actually. Yeah. Now, what's interesting about this system is this is also the system that's used in relationships and affiliation. So just like our relationships can excite us and we get excited, we go to parties, also our relationships can soothe and calm us. So if you imagine a child who's distressed, they run to mum, mum picks them up, gives them a cuddle, there we are, there we are. And this is a calming, soothing input.
Yeah.
So this is what we mean by the soothing system, the ability to be able to calm distress through a process of experiencing kindness from others or sometimes ourselves. So that's very important. So the question that you're asking is, can you be too kind or too compassionate to people and always trying to say, well, I think this is a really, really good question. And I think the point of this question is that one has to understand what is the basis of compassion. Now, the difficult story for compassion is this. If you had a chance to shoot Hitler, would you? Okay? Before he did any damage. Right? And for the compassion issue is a moral debate. Now, in my view, yes, you would, okay, because you would then save a lot of individuals, but other people may argue against that. The point about it is there is a debate. There is a debate to be had around these kinds of issues, that compassion doesn't have it's not a recipe. There's no recipe to say this is what you should do, this is not what you should do. In the case of forgiveness, it's the same thing. Now, forgiveness is an interesting one, and there's been quite a lot of research done on forgiveness. For example, looking at Jewish people and how they came to terms with Nazis and the loss of their families in the death camps. Yeah. And what they discovered was that actually genuine forgiveness was associated with better well-being and physical health than people who carried a lot of vengeance. But there are also individuals who try to be forgiven because they thought it was a good thing to do, because their religion demanded it, because they were nice people, and because they didn't want to have to confront a lot of rage, sorrow, and stuff, right? Yeah. So forgiveness can be used defensively to block off things that are difficult for you. Mm. Forgiveness has a sequence to it, right? Firstly is the recognition of the harm and the hurt that's been done, and that's often associated with allowing yourself to experience rage and a desire for vengeance. The second stage is realizing that that desire for vengeance in the end is only going to damage you, because if you live with that in your head, in your heart, you're not going to be very happy, and it's very bad for your health, and it just doesn't, you know, do anything really. So from your point of view, learning to get rid of, or deal with, get rid of is the wrong word, but learning to deal with, tolerate, and work with your desire for vengeance is actually the important part of forgiveness. So we realize that actually forgiveness is important, because we actually say, okay, I forgive you to the extent that I no longer seek vengeance against you. I no longer plan it. I no longer ruminating about it. I let you go free. I'm no longer going to seek vengeance for you. And that really is what forgiveness is about. Now, you can take it on from there and say, well, what then happens is people can begin to see that actually all of us are potentially killers. And that's much more tricky. We often say, I say to my patients, look, if I had been stolen as a 3-day-old baby and taken and brought up in a very violent drug gang, if I'd been kidnapped out of the hospital, This version of Paul Gilbert wouldn't exist.
Mm.
The version that would exist would probably be quite a violent drug baron, okay? Because I'm, you know, reasonably bright, obviously, and I would have used my intelligence in the context in which I had grown up.
Yes.
If you, and this is the tragedy, that people end up doing horrible things because of circumstances they never chose, because of a brain they never chose, because of genes they never chose, because of a background they never chose. And the point is, you begin to realize that this thing we call the self, right, that we're so wedded to, actually it's only a version. It's not really you, because what's really you is this, you know, the consciousness and all that stuff. You know, you imagine twins in Israel, and one of them is stolen and brought up in Palestine, right? And as a Palestinian person, they both get to, you know, two guys, they both get to 23 years old, and they could find themselves killing each other, you know. And why, you know, so the compassion really allows you, in the process of forgiveness, of dropping the desire for vengeance, the compassion a bit comes in and thinks, well, actually, there but the grace of. And this sense of self is very, very fragile.
Yeah.
So it's a tricky one, this. So forgiveness has a series of stages, but what's important is it's not there just because you want to feel you're a good, forgiving person and therefore God will love you. You've got to be able to work with your rage. You've got to be able to acknowledge and work with your desire for vengeance, and then work through that and see that that's only damaging you, and then work through that and recognize that actually all of us are potentially killers.
Yeah.
That's taking you into the shadow in the green sense, you know.
Okay, well, listen, Paul, I'd love to talk to you all day, but we've run out of time here. So thank you very much anyway. It's been absolutely fascinating, and thank you.
Well, it's my pleasure, Barry. Thank you for asking me. I hope it's helpful.
Great.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.